Imagine launching a grassroots rebellion against, the most powerful empire on Earth, and your opening strategic move is to just walk out into a desolate wasteland and completely starve yourself for 40 days.
I mean, it completely defies logic, but that is the stark, really unsettling image we're presented with at the very beginning of our source document today.
Right, yeah. For you listening, we are diving into the fourth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. And our mission today is to look at this text not as a gentle, sanitized sermon, but really as a raw historical document.
Exactly. We have to keep in mind the world this was written in. We're exploring the intense political pressure cooker of first century Judea.
And the incredibly high-stakes drama of Jesus launching his public mission.
Right, we're analyzing this as a literary and historical text just to understand the cultural mechanics at play.
Yeah, and a quick note before we dive in, our source document specifically deals with some very intense politically charged dynamics involving, ruling elites, oppressors, and grassroots
Which
resistance.
is heavy stuff.
It is. So we want to make it absolutely clear to you that we are not taking political sides here, nor are we endorsing these specific viewpoints for today's modern world.
Right. Our goal is to understand how the text frames these events and what that meant to a first century audience living under imperial rule.
Yeah, we are simply impartially reporting the historical tensions and power dynamics exactly as the original source material lays them out.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this because the narrative arc of this chapter is built entirely around the concept of power. The chapter opens by just dropping us straight into the wilderness.
Right into it.
Yeah, Jesus is fasting in this completely unforgiving, desolate environment for 40 days. It is a period of extreme, punishing isolation.
I mean, the physical and really the psychological toll of 40 days without food, it just cannot be overstated.
Oh,
You're looking
totally.
at a state of near total physical depletion.
Which changes how we need to view the scene. It's not like an athlete doing extreme altitude training to prep their muscles for a big game, right?
No. Altitude training builds physical capacity.
Right, this is the exact opposite. It's much more like a military resistance fighter undergoing intense interrogation resistance training.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
You strip away every single physical comfort. You push the human body to the absolute brink of starvation, really to see if your core convictions will hold up under ultimate duress.
Because he is completely vulnerable at this point.
Exactly.
Well, what's fascinating here is the heavy historical and cultural symbolism woven into this specific time frame.
The 40 days.
Right, those 40 days in the wilderness, they directly mirror Israel's 40 years of wandering in the desert after escaping Egypt.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, our source text is deliberately framing Jesus as the faithful representative of Israel. He's out there reliving the exact trial of his ancestors.
Wow, so it's a direct parallel.
Completely. The underlying theological claim the document makes is that he's succeeding where the ancient nation previously failed. He faces the extreme deprivation, yet he maintains his faithfulness.
And that deprivation culminates in this surreal face-to-face showdown with the devil. And the text introduces a massive political tension right here.
Huge tension.
The devil takes him up to a very high mountain and shows him, quote, all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. In verses 8 through 10, the devil offers him a deal.
A massive deal.
Right, absolute global dominion if Jesus will just fall down and worship him.
To really understand the weight of that offer, you have to look at the geopolitical reality of first century Judea and Galilee.
Well,
The population was living in a total pressure cooker.
under Rome.
Exactly. You had the Roman imperial machine acting as an occupying military force,
Okay.
and alongside them, you had the Herodian dynasty.
The Herodians being the local puppet kings, essentially.
Correct. They were client rulers appointed by Rome to collect taxes and keep the peace, and they often did so brutally.
Right.
So the Jewish expectation at this specific moment in history was largely for a militant Messiah.
They wanted a fighter.
Yes. They were waiting for a conquering hero, like a new King David, who would violently overthrow the Roman and Herodian oppressors and restore their national sovereignty.
Which means Satan isn't just offering him a generic temptation here.
Not at all.
He is offering him the exact thing the people already want him to do.
He's offering a political shortcut. Satan is essentially saying, you can have the absolute global dominion everyone expects you to take.
Just skip the hard part.
Right. You can bypass the suffering, skip the cross, and just seize the throne right now. It preys directly on that first century hunger for an immediate militant earthly empire.
But Jesus forcefully rejects that worldly definition of power, right? He refuses the shortcut.
Yeah,
he chooses a completely different path, one of divine reliance. And he famously quotes the ancient scriptures saying, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God."
So he passes the ultimate test.
Yeah.
He totally rejects the temptation of imperial dominance. But the narrative pacing here, I mean, it's relentless.
It doesn't slow down at all.
No, the moment he survives this intense spiritual gauntlet in the cosmic realm, he is immediately dragged into a brutal, real-world political crisis.
Right. The text states that as soon as he comes out of the wilderness, he gets hit with the news that Herod Antipas has arrested John the Baptist.
Yeah.
So we go from a theological debate about global kingdoms straight into the harsh reality of how actual kingdoms operate.
And John the Baptist was a highly visible, highly vocal figure. Our source document uses his arrest as a stark reminder of how ruling elites actually functioned.
Because he called them out.
Exactly. Herod Antipas imprisoned John because John publicly criticized Herod's morality and behavior.
Wow.
Yeah, in the ancient world, calling out a ruler's personal life was viewed as political sedition. The elites ruthlessly suppressed any prophetic voices that dared to challenge their grip on power.
Which serves as an implicit death threat to anyone else preaching a similar message, right?
Yeah, without a doubt.
If you are doing what John was doing, you are next on Herod's list. And here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Because the natural human response to a death threat from the government is usually fight or flight. You lay completely low, or you march straight to the capital to fight the elites head on.
Right.
But the text says Jesus withdraws to a place called Galilee of the Gentiles. And specifically, he sets up his headquarters in Capernaum. Wait, let me stop you there.
Okay.
If there's an active death threat from the ruling elites, why not just go completely into hiding? Because Capernaum was a major international crossroads with tax collectors stationed right there.
Yeah, it was very busy.
Moving to a busy trade hub seems like a terrible way to lay low. Wasn't he just walking into a different trap?
Well, that assumes his goal was to hide.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, moving to Capernaum reveals an absolutely brilliant strategic maneuver.
Really?
Yeah, you have to look at the demographics. Galilee was a northern region, geographically and culturally distanced from the strict religious elites down south in Jerusalem. The text specifically calls it Galilee of the Gentiles, Gentiles being non-Jewish people. The area had been heavily influenced by previous Greek colonization.
So it's a culturally mixed hybrid zone.
Highly mixed. And because of that demographic diversity, the religious center of power in Jerusalem viewed Galilee as a semi-autonomous, somewhat despised periphery. It was a backwater to them.
I see.
But Capernaum itself was a bustling commercial fishing town on the Sea of Galilee. And more importantly, it sat squarely on the major international trade routes, often referred to as the Via Maris.
Oh, the trade routes.
Right. Caravans traveling from Egypt to Syria had to pass through there, which is exactly why the Romans set up tax booths in the town.
Ah, so he isn't hiding from the empire. He is exploiting its infrastructure.
Yes.
He sets up his base in a commercial center filled with travelers and merchants.
It is the ancient equivalent of a viral marketing hub. By positioning himself at a crossroads of trade, he ensured that his message would spread organically.
Explain the mechanics of how that actually worked, though. We say viral marketing, but obviously there's no internet. How does an idea go viral in a first century fishing town?
Right. It relies entirely on the oral tradition and the movement of commerce. Merchants would stop in Capernaum to rest their caravans, trade goods, and pay taxes.
Makes sense.
And while in town, they would hear Jesus teaching or witness a healing. They would memorize the parables, which, by the way, were specifically designed to be easily remembered.
Oh, wow.
And then a week later, they would share those stories around a fire at an inn hundreds of miles away.
That's incredible. The ideas hitch a ride with the economy. People just pack up their caravans and take his teachings to entirely different countries.
Exactly.
It is a genius move of nonviolent resistance. He subverts the earthly power structures not by attacking the capital with swords, but by launching a grassroots movement from the margins. He uses the empire's own trade routes to bypass their censorship.
It's brilliant.
But to sustain a grassroots movement that size, you cannot operate alone. You need a network to help manage the crowds and spread the teachings.
Which brings us to the drama of the calling. Jesus is walking by the Sea of Galilee, and he needs a team to execute this massive mission. And the text describes an incredibly sudden event.
They're very sudden.
He sees two brothers, Peter and Andrew, who are fishermen, casting their nets. Then he sees two more brothers, James and John, in a boat mending their nets with their father Zebedee.
And the invitation he gives them is famously brief. In Matthew chapter 4, verses 19 and 20, he says, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men."
And the text notes that they immediately left their nets and followed him.
Immediately.
We really need to pause and examine the socioeconomic reality of that decision.
Here.
Because these guys aren't just out fishing for a hobby on a Saturday afternoon. This is their livelihood.
Yeah, fishing on the Sea of Galilee was an industrial family syndicate. It was hard, grueling work, heavily taxed by Rome, but it provided a stable living.
And it was an entrenched family business. Absolutely. I mean, James and John literally walk away from their father Zebedee, leaving him sitting in the boat with the hired servants.
Wow.
In a first century honor and shame culture, abandoning your family trade and your father in the middle of a workday is a massive social breach.
It's social and financial suicide. So what does this all mean? I feel like it is the modern equivalent of someone walking out of a highly stable, lucrative corporate job.
Totally.
You leave your laptop open on the desk, cut up your safety net to join an unfunded startup, a startup that promises absolutely no financial security, a massive amount of political risk, and a revolution.
This raises an important question. What exactly were they signing up for?
Right.
They are leaving everything behind, so the pitch must have been incredibly compelling. Our source text shows that Jesus essentially takes up the exact mantle that just got John the Baptist arrested.
The exact same message.
Yes. His core thesis, found in verse 17, is repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.
A kingdom. He rejected the kingdoms of the world from the devil, but he is still building a kingdom. It just operates on completely different metrics.
The contrast is the whole point of the chapter.
Yeah.
Satan offered a kingdom built on military might, domination, and political shortcuts.
Yeah.
Jesus begins building a kingdom based on spiritual renewal, teaching, and servanthood. The text says he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and affliction among the people.
He replaces the sword with healing. And the response from the population is just staggering.
It's massive.
The chapter closes by describing these massive, overwhelming crowds flocking to him. And look at where they're coming from. The text says his fame spread throughout all Syria, and crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan.
The inclusion of the Decapolis in that list is incredibly telling.
Why is that?
The Decapolis was a league of 10 Hellenistic cities. These were deeply Greek, highly Romanized urban centers.
Oh.
They had pagan temples, amphitheaters, and a culture completely foreign to traditional Judaism.
Yet the people living in those pagan Romanized cities are packing up and trekking into the wilderness to listen to a Jewish rabbi preach about a new kingdom.
Exactly.
The viral strategy of Capernaum is working flawlessly.
It demonstrates the radical, cross-cultural appeal of his message. The chapter gives us the launch of a public mission that completely flips the script on how influence and transformation operate.
Yeah, he completely bypassed the political shortcut.
Relocated to the marginalized periphery.
And ignited an explosion of grassroots influence that the central authorities simply could not contain.
Yeah.
It is a breathtaking narrative when you actually examine the political and historical mechanics underneath the text. And as we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with one final, deeply provocative thought to chew on.
A really important one.
Something that builds on everything we just discussed, but really highlights the human element of this historical account. I want you to consider the immense psychological fortitude that Jesus displayed in this timeline.
When you map out the chronological sequence of chapter 4, the bravery is quite chilling.
Exactly. Think about the sequence here. He had just starved himself for 40 days.
Yeah, battling absolute physical and psychological exhaustion.
Right. And the very moment he finishes that trial, he receives the news that John the Baptist, the man who preceded him, the man preaching the exact same message, has been thrown into a dungeon by a ruthless, insecure ruler.
Right. John's arrest is a crystal clear neon sign blueprint of exactly what happens to political dissidents in the first century.
It is a guaranteed promise of imprisonment and death.
The crosshairs were perfectly visible. The empire showed its hand.
And Jesus chose that exact moment to step directly into the public eye.
He didn't retreat to a cave.
No, he moved to a busy international trade hub, stood in front of massive crowds, and amplified the exact same message that just put John in chains.
He didn't blink.
He didn't soften the rhetoric at all. Think about the sheer unwavering conviction required to walk willingly into the crosshairs of an empire like that.
It fundamentally recontextualizes the entire narrative. It wasn't a peaceful, serene walk on the beach. It was a highly calculated step into the ultimate danger zone.
It changes everything about how you read those verses. Now, I want to turn this over to you. Head down to the comments right now and drop your thoughts on today's historical drama. Seriously, what do you make of Jesus' strategic move to Galilee instead of facing the religious elites down in Jerusalem?
Was it pure pragmatism or something deeper?
Let us know what you think. And hey, if you enjoyed today's deep dive into the source material, make sure you hit that like button and subscribe to the channel so you never miss out on these breakdowns.
Yeah, definitely subscribe.
Also, do not forget to check the description below for some exclusive links related to today's deep dive to keep your learning going. You absolutely need to tune in next time, because if you thought the political tension in Chapter 4 was high, our next deep dive will be even more intense as we see the ruling elites start pushing back. We will see you then.